A reading from the Song of Solomon. The voice of my beloved, look, he comes, leaping upon the mountains, bounding over the hills. My beloved is like a gazelle or a young stag. Look, there he stands behind our wall, gazing in at the windows, looking through the lattice. My beloved speaks and says to me, arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. For now the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of singing has come, and the voice of the turtle dove is heard in our land. The fig tree puts forth its figs, and the vines are in blossom. They give forth fragrance. Arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Thanks be to God.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Mark. Now when the Pharisees and some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem gathered around him, they noticed that some of his disciples were eating with defiled hands, that is, without washing them. For the Pharisees and all the Jews did not eat unless they thoroughly washed their hands, thus observing the tradition of the elders, and they do not eat anything from the market unless they wash it. And there are also many other traditions that they observe, the washing of cups, pots, and bronze kettles. So the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, why do your disciples not live according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with defiled hands? He said to them, Isaiah prophesies rightly about you hypocrites. As it is written, this people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. In vain they do worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrines. You abandon the commandment of God and hold to human tradition. But you say that if anyone tells father or mother, whatever support you might have had from me is korban, that is, an offering to God. Then he called the crowd again and said to them, listen to me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going in can defile, but the things that come out are what defile. For it is from within, from the human heart, that evil intentions come, fornication, theft, murder, adultery, avarice, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, envy, slander, pride, folly. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person. The Gospel of Christ.
2 weeks ago, I had confessed that the scriptures we used had nothing to do with the lectionary whatsoever. Last week, I said that I used one of the readings from the lectionary, and the gospel reading, I simply changed the chapter, but at least it was the same gospel. Today, 100% Revised Common Lectionary. The readings you heard are the readings that were assigned. And what's kind of interesting about this is something that happens from time to time. Even though the lectionary was established years and years and years ago, and the rhythm of when we're supposed to read, what we're reading, was already put in place, and I don't want anybody to read into this at all, please understand, but it just so happens that every once in a while, the readings tend to match rather well something else that's going on outside of the church calendar. Whether it's some thing in the news or something going on locally or what have you. And so it just so happens that today's readings are actually kind of suitable for the fact that the Pride Parade is happening in Calgary in about 45 minutes. The first reading that we heard today is from the book of the Song of Solomon, also known as the Song of Songs. And this book, if you are prepared to dispense with the needless tendency for Christian interpreters to make it a metaphor of Christ's love for the church, you don't have to do that with this book. If you let it stand for what it is the account of a woman who is taken up with a man who is taken up with a woman, and they fall in love, and they communicate their desire for each other, and then they get married, and the book ends with them launching into that idea of marital bliss. It's called the Song of Solomon because Solomon's name shows up 7 times in it, and there's reason to believe that King Solomon himself is the man involved in this particular romantic relationship. And so here we have this account, this book that's sort of in the middle of the Hebrew Bible, that celebrates love, that leads to marriage and what it can be. And of course, we are in the midst, even today still, of controversy and debate over same-sex marriage. Within the Anglican Church of Canada, there are bishops and parishes that endorse and practice same-sex marriage. And within the Anglican Church of Canada, there are bishops and parishes that do not endorse nor practice same-sex marriage. The debate continues to go on. But this morning, I thought it would be suitable to, using these scriptures and an overview of the scriptures, talk about why I think same-sex marriage is not a bad idea at all. In fact, it's something that ought to be practiced. And part of it has to do with us simply taking a look at this understanding of marriage and where it came from and what our understanding of marriage today is, what our tradition of marriage is today. Now, if a person has a more evangelical bent in their Christianity, what you can do is just deal with the scriptures alone, and that's all you need if you want to get the answer. We as Anglicans recognize that there's scripture and tradition and reason that make up that package. Sometimes experience gets thrown in there as well. But either way, the starting point is always the scriptures. So if the traditional Christian idea of marriage, which has been held for hundreds of years, is that marriage is between one man and one woman at the exclusion of all others and it's for life, where does all this come from? Well, we don't have time to talk about every nuance of that definition, but let's at least begin at the beginning. In Genesis chapter 2, in the second creation story, we're told that the Lord God, that is Yahweh God, formed man from the dust of the ground and breathed into his nostrils the breath of life, and man became a living being. And then, because man was alone and God saw this was not a good idea, he put him to sleep, took out his rib, and from that rib formed woman. And so in that picture, it's a couple of ways it can be interpreted. Either God created an androgynous being from the ground, and then through this act of creation divided them into male and female. Or God created a full-blown man, and then from him took a rib to create woman. In either case, the rationale for this move is said in Genesis chapter 2. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, and the two will become one flesh. And so whoever wrote Genesis chapter 2, of course, is writing after the fact, after this idea of the first creation of humans, and is saying that the practice of marriage that was already a reality in the author's life has its origin in how God created humanity to start with. That's essentially what's happening. This is why a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, because this is what God did, created the human being and then brought a woman out of the man, and there they are. Okay, that works. There's logic associated with that. The problem is we know that that's not how it went down. We've come to understand through our scientific research that there was no point at which there weren't any humans, and then all of a sudden two humans showed up, and from those two humans came the rest of the human race. We recognize that Homo sapiens, us, we showed up 200,000 years ago after a process of evolution of hominids, and prior to Homo sapiens was, you know, Homo erectus and the Denisovians and Homo neanderthalensis, and then Homo sapiens shows up, and it's really unlikely that at the moment we crossed the threshold for Homo sapiens that there were only two, even. Either way, the practice of marriage cannot be attributed to the beginning as it is described in the scriptures if it didn't happen that way. 3,000 years ago, when that story of creation was written, it made sense because that was the understanding. But we've understood that reality is different. So appealing to creation in that way is a difficult thing to sustain now for our doctrine and tradition of marriage. What also becomes a challenge is looking at how marriage is handled in the scriptures. Starting with the Hebrew Bible and going into the New Testament, we find a rather interesting way. In fact, we would not recognize marriage, the way it's handled in the scriptures, the way we practice it today. Let's begin just by, and of course there's tons of examples I can bring, I'm going to pull out some highlights. Jacob, his name was changed into Israel. And he had two wives and two concubines. And we know that that wasn't the way it was supposed to be, but the fact that he had two wives and two concubines was never portrayed as being a moral problem. It was simply because he was the victim of a circumstance in which his father-in-law pulled a fast one on him, and then because his two wives were having difficulty having kids. And so, as was the custom there, hey, why don't you sleep with my maidservant, each wife saying that, and because my maidservant, essentially my slave, belongs to me, any of her children are effectively mine, and in this way I can bear children for you. Does that sound like a really good system that we ought to operate with today? No, not at all, but that was the way it was, and it wasn't communicated as being a real issue. Instead, what we find is from those four women, Jacob had 12 sons, who became the 12 patriarchs of the 12 tribes of Israel. And so the entire nation of Israel, God's chosen people, are descended from two wives and two concubines, and nothing is said about the morality of that situation. It's simply the way it was done. So polygamy is something that ended up being a fairly common part of the human experience and in the experience in Israel as well. When we come to the kings, we get to see things change a little bit more. King David had 8 wives. And then the book of Chronicles says he also had concubines. Now, when you've got someone who's a king, you can say, well, you know, story's a little bit different for the king. I mean, he's the king. He can do what he wants, right? Well, there's a limit even on a king's morality too, isn't there? Or shouldn't there be? But very little is said about anything with regard to the morals of King David's 8 wives. In fact, we should acknowledge that some of his wives would have been diplomatic marriages. Because he was the king, he took on wives from other nations, which is curious. How a diplomatic marriage works is like this. Let's say I'm the king of a nation right here. And there's a neighboring nation over there, and I'm concerned that that king might want to attack my kingdom. What I'll do is I'll negotiate being able to marry his daughter and take her into my harem, and that will prevent him from wanting to attack me because then it'll do damage to his daughter. And then if this kingdom over here is also perceived by me to be a threat, I will engage in diplomacy to marry that king's daughter and bring her into my harem so that he'll be less likely to attack me as well. So now maybe I have a queen who I married for love to start with, but now I have 2 more wives with this diplomatic connection. And of course, all the benefits and privileges that come along with having 2 more women as my wives. So some of David's wives would have fallen in that category. The only marriage of David's that is really looked at negatively from a moral standpoint is his 8th wife, and that is Bathsheba. Because that scenario was completely a power play on his part. He saw her bathing naked. He was turned on. He said, I want her. He arranged for her to be brought to the palace. He has sex with her, ostensibly against her will, gets her pregnant, realizes this, arranges for her husband to be killed off so that he can now marry her, this widow who would now be destitute without her husband, brings her into his harem, and now he finally gets what he wants. The scriptures do talk about how he was called on the carpet for that one. But it had less to do with the fact that she was wife number 8 and more to do with the fact that he had committed murder and adultery in getting this woman to now be part of his harem. Her son, by the way, was given the name Solomon and interestingly became the next king of Israel. Now, when it comes to Solomon, Solomon was one who was held up in the spotlight as doing something bad because he had, they say, 700 wives and 300 concubines. Now, I think those numbers are inflated somewhat, partly because there's a limit to a man's energy level. But, I mean, we can see with it being 700 and 300, you know, that is probably one of those symbolic numbers, right? He's 1,000 women, right? However many it was, the point is he had a lot. Now, I did discover that rabbis had determined that there was an understanding that a king in Israel could have up to 18 wives, but no more. I haven't been able to find where that was, but I've come across it a couple of times. But even still, 18, right? But Solomon was said to have so many more wives than that. The problem is, this was only a problem for 2 reasons, and neither one of them was moral. The reason this was an issue that Solomon had so many wives and concubines was, first of all, it created a burden for the economy of Israel. Now their taxes had to go up because Solomon had so many mouths to feed. He had such a large household to sustain. The Bible tells us that this became a burden to Israel. Solomon was having to grab more money from the Israelites to sustain this bloated household. And the second issue with all of his wives and his concubines is that they were foreign women who worshipped other gods. And Solomon ended up worshiping those other gods with his wives rather than worshiping Yahweh alone. So the only two problems with Solomon's marriages was that it was expensive and it led to idolatry. Says nothing about the morality of the situation. There's no sanction against how he even got those wives. I find it interesting that, you know, Solomon married foreign wives. David, in all likelihood, did too, and yet it was only an issue for Solomon. But be that as it may, that's beside the point. You know, it's curious. When we turn to the book of the Song of Solomon, this lovely and poetic description of romantic love leading to marriage. If indeed King Solomon is the guy in this story, which wife is she? Is she his first wife? Or is she his 57th wife? Or is she wife number 432? That kind of changes the purity of the romance, doesn't it? I mean, from her perspective, from the woman's perspective in this book, we can see how she is enamored with the king, the fact that she was one who wasn't in his social standing. She was one who works outside. You can tell because she would be exposed to the sun, so her skin would be darker rather than the, you know, luxurious, lighter colored skin. Her skin was darker because she worked outside all the time. She was a working woman, and yet the king still saw her. And so we could see her wanting to give her heart to him. But if she's the 57th wife, it takes something out of his words of love and passion for her, doesn't it? But we don't often think about that when we read the book of Song of Solomon. Polygamy continued to be practiced throughout the history of Israel. It was not mandated that it must happen, but for those that didn't practice polygamy, the reason they didn't probably had to do with economic reasons. Because, of course, the man would be the one to support the woman. And so if you can only afford one wife, then you're going to limit yourself to one wife. Unless you've got the resources to have two or three or six, you're not going to go there. And this economic piece was also part of marriage in the ancient Near East. If a woman was ever widowed, she would be facing destitution unless she had a male to support her, either a son who would then take care of her, or unless she was able to find another husband to marry her and bring her into his household. So the economic piece was part of the package. And there is a law in the Torah which is referring to a kinsman redeemer. And what this is all about is to make sure that women are taken care of should they lose their husbands. Well, that's a small part of the arrangement. The kinsman redeemer law works like this. Let's say I got married to my wife and we didn't have any kids and then I died. Now my wife is a widow without any children, especially without a son. The kinsman redeemer law requires my next closest male relative, let's say my younger brother, even if he's already married, needs to marry my wife and then have sex with her until she produces a son so that my name, the dead husband, can be carried on in perpetuity. Now, there is this benefit that the widow is being taken care of and is now being provided for, but the purpose for this arrangement, why they are to be in sexual relations, is simply for a son to be born to her to pass on my name. So let me ask you this question. What if she has three girls before having a boy? Well, this sexual relationship is supposed to continue. Does the brother even really love my widowed wife? Perhaps not. How does she feel about him? Doesn't matter. What does his wife feel about? Doesn't matter. It's in the law. And this was already being practiced even in the time of Jesus. Jesus has to talk about this kind of thing. And one of the debates that happens in the scriptures in Matthew chapter 19, it looks like it's pointing towards a monogamous relationship, but not necessarily so. Jesus is in a debate with the Pharisees who are trying to talk about whether it's acceptable to divorce your wife. And Jesus will say, I tell you the truth, if a man divorces his wife except for unchastity or marital unfaithfulness, if a man divorces his wife and marries another, he commits adultery. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no one separate, right? And so that is sometimes taken up as being, well, here, Jesus is arguing for monogamy. Well, not necessarily. Because he's talking about is being married to a woman and then divorcing her and then marrying another is adultery. He doesn't say that if you're married to a woman and then you marry another woman that you're committing adultery, the issue is divorcing the first one. And again, with this kinsman-redeemer arrangement, well, that has to be okay. Go ahead and maintain faithfulness to your first marriage, but now you have to take in this second one for the sake of your brother's name. So even in the time of Jesus, there was room for polygamy. It's not until 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1 that we start to see a clearer picture that Christian tradition moved towards strict monogamy. These two letters are usually attributed to Paul, but it's highly unlikely he wrote them. These were probably written late in the first century, whereas the Apostle Paul was put to death at 64 CE. And here in 1 Timothy and in Titus, it's talking about church leadership, giving qualifications for those who want to be bishops, priests, and deacons. And the instructions say, among other things, if we take the literal translation from the Greek, it says, he must be the husband of but one wife. Now, the New Revised Standard Version says that anyone who wants to be a bishop, priest, or deacon must be married only once. And part of the reason for translating it that way is to move away from one conclusion that the original text would say and to help clarify what might be meant by the rest. Here it is. The original translation says he must be the husband of but one wife. Well, that means then, of course, he has to be a male. Church leaders have to be guys, right? Because if you're a girl, you can't be the husband of a wife, right? So the NRSV has softened that to be more inclusive because we have come to recognize there's no reason for women not to be able to be leaders in the church. But then husband of but one wife, what does that mean? Well, it sounds like it means you can't be a polygamist. You must have only one wife. And surely that meaning is included there. But then why does the NRSV say they must be married only once? Well, because there's this thing called serial monogamy, which usually involves divorce. You're married to one woman, you divorce her, you're married to another, you're still only practicing monogamy, right? If she passes away and you marry another, you've got a third wife, but you're still a monogamist, right? Because you're just marrying one woman. That whole scenario, especially the divorce and remarriage piece, it was probably also being argued against with those instructions. And so the NRSV just says, look, you just got to be married only once. Technically then, a divorced person ought not to be a church leader, according to 1 Timothy and Titus. Of course, we have seen in the 2,000 years since that our tradition has not made that as exclusive an issue as the scriptures seem to have us do. What we see in this journey through the scriptures is how marriage is practiced and how it is upheld is a far cry from what we have come to understand marriage to be today. We would never define marriage the way the Bible allows marriage to be. So what has happened over the past 2,000 years? Have we stepped away from the Bible? I mean, think about these things. You know, okay, well, it's for the woman's economic benefit to be able to be married. Do you know what we call women who marry just for money these days? They're gold diggers, right? And we don't talk about that in a positive way. Well, it's important. Marriage is important for, like, you know, the king and that diplomacy and status in society and stuff. Anybody who's been a fan of Downton Abbey will see that even just 125 years ago, among the aristocracy in Britain, one of the big concerns was marry the right person of the right standing, even though love was never part of the package. You just marry for the right standing. And then even though in both Victorian and Edwardian England, it would be understood that adultery is a bad thing, and adultery is consistently a bad thing in the scriptures, nevertheless, it was understood that these men and women who marry for their station in life will usually end up having a fling and a mistress or something where their passion is actually communicated. What about kids? Sometimes the argument comes up that marriage really is about the children. It's about having kids. Let me simply say, because it needs to be said, even though it's obvious, marriage doesn't produce kids. Sex produces kids. And so you don't have to be married in order to produce children. But we have in our tradition, and when you read the Book of Common Prayer and also the marriage liturgy in the Book of Alternative Services, the raising of children and the rearing of children is part of the package when it comes to marriage. We have in our tradition made that a part of what marriage is all about. But the interesting thing is, in the Book of Alternative Services, the references to bearing children are bracketed out in the liturgy. I can conduct a wedding ceremony without referring to raising children. Well, why would that be? Well, because we've come to understand that having kids is not the point of marriage. It can be what marriage produces, but if marriage is all about having kids, then if a couple doesn't have kids, can they be validly married? Well, some people say, well, it needs to be that the possibility is there. And this is one of the reasons against same-sex marriage, for example. It's like there needs to be the possibility of kids emerging. Well, by that logic then, if you happen to be widowed and you're postmenopausal, guess you can't be married because there's no way you're going to have kids. Or if something happens in your life, you sustain an injury that affects your potency or what have you, sorry, no matter how much you want to, you can't be married because there's no possibility that kids can come out of that. The reason childbearing is part of the marriage thing is because of what we have come to understand marriage is all about. And this is what is celebrated at any wedding ceremony I do. Two people come together and they make vows before the people assembled. And if it's a religious ceremony, those vows are also said before God that they are going to love each other. They're going to love, honor, and cherish each other. They're going to do this until death parts them. We counsel them before the wedding that we're going to get together and we're going to figure out how to understand each other and how to choose to continue to love each other and cultivate that relationship and let it stand for years and decades to come, that there would be this giving that each partner gives to the other and this willingness to continue to make it into something beautiful. And let me ask you, is that not the perfect environment in which to raise children? Of course it is, which is why we emphasize marriage being important for the raising of children. Because when two people come together in that kind of commitment and that kind of relationship, what better place is there for kids to emerge? But you don't have to have kids in order to still cultivate that intense, intimate, committed, unconditional, loving relationship between two people. And you don't have to be of the opposite sex to do that. You know, the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians 7, if you can't control yourself and you're just spreading your wild oats everywhere, go ahead and get married. It's better to marry than burn with passion. If someone came up to me and said, Reverend Duren, would you marry my girlfriend and me? We just really got to have sex. We just can't control ourselves. We got to do it. I would say that's a poor reason to get married. The Apostle Paul thinks it's fine. I would never do that. I don't think any of us would ever endorse marrying somebody just because they can't control themselves. That is a bad foundation. The Apostle Paul's view of marriage in 1 Corinthians 7 is obviously different from how we view marriage today. So what has our tradition done? Have we moved away from the scriptures? In seeing this trajectory from Genesis through to 1 Timothy and Titus, where we see the move towards monogamy, have we now gone beyond that? Or have we continued the trajectory over the past 2,000 years and realized that the best context for marriage is going beyond polygamy and economic benefit and trying to let your dead brother's line continue and move towards the idea of a relationship that is modeled on mutual love and unconditional commitment to one another? If that tradition that we have now insists that it must be heterosexual only, I suggest to you there's weak arguments for sustaining that part of the tradition. I'll close with just a quick reference to our gospel reading today. Mark chapter 7. Jesus is in his debate with the Pharisees because his apostles are not washing their hands. They're not keeping with the traditions of the elders. The reading was truncated. They left out parts of it. And one of Jesus' responses was to say, look, you talk about the tradition of the elders. You have a fine way of setting aside the truth for the traditions of the elders. And then he paints this picture where a person can choose to say, I'm going to take these resources of mine and I'm going to declare them korban. In other words, I am devoting them to God. These resources of mine are going to God because I love Yahweh so much. I am so pious. I am so holy. I am so spiritual. This is what I'm going to do. And the fact that my elderly parents now cannot be supported by me like they're supposed to, because I have dedicated my resources to God instead, Jesus is saying, what are you, nuts? This tradition of the elders, this declaring your stuff korban before God at the expense of supporting your mom and dad who raised you? No, that's not how this is supposed to work. You think it's spiritual, and it's not. You think that this is something delightful, but it is harming these people that you're supposed to support. Now, I admit, it is not a perfect parallel. I admit that. But I am just suggesting to you that an insistence upon heterosexual marriage alone is keeping our homosexual brothers and sisters and our bisexual brothers and sisters, and our transgendered brothers and sisters who love another person so deeply and want to make that same commitment and that same vow to cultivate a relationship that is so deep, that is indeed reflective of Christ's love for the church. And we're saying, no, you can't. And our reasons for it, I would suggest, are on shaky ground. And so this morning, as the Pride Parade gets underway in about 15 minutes, a parade that's meant to have our queer brothers and sisters saying, hey, make room for us in society. I think it would be good for us to make room for them in allowing them to get married, whether they're of the opposite sex or the same sex or whatever. Let's allow this commitment of love to be displayed between two people prepared to make that commitment. Amen.